to the Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. That's right.
We won't make any jokes about the weekend.
And Richard, it's 8:03, which means that we're getting closer and closer to what we have set as our regular start time.
8 o'clock start time.
We're getting better and better. You know what? That's all you can ask for.
And we're going to limit it to an hour, correct?
Yeah, we'll just go just under an hour.
Okay.
Just to kind of stay on schedule and all of that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So today's podcast, I'm excited about today's podcast, like I am usually, I think. But I'm excited about today's podcast because we started this idea probably on Monday. On Monday morning, I wrote a blog post. It was an observation that came to mind when watching some of the some of the political debates and reading some of the political commentary with the presidential race going. And so I posted this blog, and it got a little bit of attention. And then I posted a follow-up on Tuesday about what cognitive dissonance is. But so today's podcast is entitled Religion, Politics, and Cognitive Dissonance.
This feels like we're standing on a thin sheet of ice.
You know, and I think that it's important that we put a little bit of a disclaimer at the beginning. Religion and politics is something that we usually don't get into much on the mental breakdown. And that's because, you know, generally speaking, you're entitled to your own beliefs. You're entitled to your own political perspectives and things like that. You know, we don't like it when others attempt to force you to believe as they do, whether it's politically or religiously. But, you know, everybody's welcome to believe what they want to believe and believe what's true to them.
Right.
And so we kind of avoid that just because, it's, like you said, it's a bit of a slippery slope, and we don't want to sort of get into a situation where we're talking about things that are going to be distressing to anybody.
Right.
That said, I think that this topic is really important because it does have some underlying principles in psychological theory that I think is really important. Part of my interest in this is academic. I'm just really interested in how people think about these kinds of things. And part of it really is to try to help people understand some of this a little bit more, because there's certainly some aspects of it that of this whole topic that I think some people question. You know, I think some people really have a hard time with it. And so so with all of that in mind, with the idea that we're not talking about or supporting or putting down any particular political affiliation, any particular religious affiliation. We're just making some observations that I think warrant conversation. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay. So
yeah. So if you're listening, I mean, don't listen too hard for, well, are these guys liberals or conservatives or Republicans or Democrats? That's not the issue here.
Right.
We're talking about this from a theoretical, philosophical, psychological perspective.
Right.
Only, and that we want to limit it to that, so that the other stuff doesn't get in the way. We think the conversation has to occur at that level rather than at a decision level.
Exactly. And so let's begin. So again, the title is Religion, Politics, and Cognitive Dissonance. And let's begin, I suppose, with a definition, or let's talk about first what cognitive dissonance is. All right? So cognitive dissonance is the phenomenon where we hold a belief despite evidence to suggest the contrary.
Right.
Okay, so we see this a lot in our practice and a lot in our field, especially with people who have depressive disorders or people who have anxiety disorders and things like that. Because people will come in and they'll say, you know, I'm always wrong. Things always go bad for me. I'm never going to succeed, despite, you know, again, evidence of the contrary, despite having succeeded with something yesterday, or despite, you know, having done very well a couple of weeks ago, and now you're feeling down, and what happens to us during these times? And when I'm talking about it with a patient, I refer to it as cognitive distortions, as opposed to cognitive dissonance. But it's the same thing.
Yeah, we usually refer to it as distortions.
Right, because they're distorting reality. They're looking at what's happening right now and generalizing it to their entire life, again, despite evidence of the contrary. Yeah. So cognitive dissonance has been is a phenomenon that's been around for or a construct that we've talked about in the field for a long time. And what we do as humans, as cognizant beings, we seek to support those beliefs. And so what we see in patients in these situations is they will look for things to support these distortions, these false beliefs. And ignore, or sometimes, many times, I don't like to use the word ignore because that makes it seem that they're aware that they're doing it. They minimize, and sometimes don't even recognize evidence of the contrary. So when we're talking about that depressed patient who is struggling with these feelings of hopelessness and worthlessness and things like that, when you give them examples from their life that these beliefs aren't true, they minimize them. They say, yeah, but wouldn't have been able to do that if this other person hadn't have done this. Or
it's always yes, but
always there's always
struggling
a
against
there.
They struggle against the evidence, even in the face of evidence they struggle against it,
right? And
it's usually that yes, but
and what they're doing there is they're looking for what we call cognitive consistency.
Right.
They're looking for anything to support and maintain consistency between their beliefs and what they feel that they're experiencing in the world. So that's the goal. We work to find cognitive consistency by dealing with the cognitive dissonance.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's cognitive dissonance.
Because our brain wants consistency, predictability,
right,
uniformity. It sort of seeks that. And so when we get a notion in our head that we're something, we seek evidence to support that.
Right. And that's very challenging for us as therapists and as psychologists, because patients tend to fight that.
That's
patients
right.
tend to resist and have a difficult time agreeing to that,
and right.
and certainly the most severe form of this is called a delusional disorder,
right.
and delusional disorders are extremely difficult to treat because
right.
Any work that you do to demonstrate evidence that their delusion isn't correct is seen as a conspiracy against them. You're one of them,
one of those, yeah.
who's trying to guide me in the wrong direction. So.
Right.
So it really is a challenge that we work with patients with a lot of different conditions and disorders. Now, just because it's present in people with various mental health concerns, doesn't restrict it to that population.
Right.
Cognitive dissonance occurs with healthy people, people who may be psychologically sound, but again, hold some beliefs about something despite the incongruent nature of things that are happening around them. And that's where we're coming up with this discussion about this what's happening with this political race right now. And this was just the example that came up from what I was seeing earlier this week, and religion. Let's talk about where this came from. This political season, we have had a lot of candidates. We have had candidates, especially on the Republican side. I think we've had a lot more on the Republican side than on the Democratic side. We've had a lot of candidates on the Republican side. And
yeah, at one point, I think there were 14.
Yeah, it was
because they'd have two separate debates,
right?
And so I think it was 8 in one and 6 in the other, or something like that.
Something like that.
So I think
that.
There were, like, at one point there were 14 candidates. A few have dropped out, but I think we still have about 7 or 8.
Right, right. And it was, that's a lot of people. You know, that's a lot of...
It's unusual to have that many, especially this late. I mean, we're into February now.
Right.
And I suppose it will winnow down some. It'll decrease some over the next couple of months, but...
Right.
That's a considerable number.
And the observation that I made, and I'm sure that I'm not the only one, or I hope I'm not the only one that made this observation. The observation that I made is that as some of the candidates began to drop out of the race, some of the names and situations raised some flags to me. It's like, wait a minute, you know, this person was saying this, you know, just a couple of months ago, and now they're dropping out. And just a couple of examples from people who have dropped out. Rick Santorum. Mm-hmm. And again, this is not a statement about his political perspectives or anything like that. But, you know, Rick Santorum and his wife talked about him running for, and eventually, you know, he was determined to be president, said that it was what God wants. Rick Perry, you know, his wife sort of equated to his decision to run for presidency to, you know, Moses and the burning bush, and that, you know, he was informed to run, they told reporters that his running was, you know, a calling from God. And then Scott Walker, is quoted as saying, you know, this is God's plan for me, and I'm humbled to be candidate for president of the United States. And those are wonderful perspectives, and I can completely appreciate their ideas and their thoughts and their feelings behind that. Where I'm coming from with this is the cognitive dissonance when they drop out of the race. You know, how do you hold in your mind, how do you hold in your awareness that, you know, that you believe that this is a calling, that you were guided, that you were missioned to do this, and then not have the votes, not have the money sometimes to be able to continue with that bid for presidency? Because that's, you know, for somebody to say, God called me to do this, that's a pretty significant statement. That's a pretty significant belief. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not a lot of us who make those kinds of claims. You know, I wouldn't make the claim that, you know, God called me to be a psychologist. You know, I may say that God called me to help other people. And then I went into the area to help people that I felt was best for me. But to say, especially on a national stage, you know, using my words as I would interpret what they're saying, you know, God called me, God told me, God led me to run for presidency because I feel that that's what He wants me to do.
Right.
I think. That's an interesting, academically, psychologically, that's an interesting place to go. It's an interesting perspective to have. And again, to say on a national stage. And I think the idea of cognitive dissonance comes in two places with this. The first is, the first place that I noticed this was when, during one of those debates that you were talking about, and all the candidates are standing on the stage, and one of them would speak first, and they would make such a statement. You know, Marco Rubio. He talks about his religion, and it's a very strong part of his belief structure and part of his what he sees for the future of the country. And so he still talks about it. But he's still in the race, and so you know, that's why I didn't include him. But if we look at some of these guys who have since dropped out, they would be on the stage, and one of them would make such a statement, and then right after he made that statement, they would go to the next candidate, and the next candidate would say the same thing. Mm. And I wonder how we process that information. You know, what does what do other people, you know, how do we rationalize the perspective that two people, two different people, strongly believe that God, their God, and they're both Christian, so we would presume that they're talking about that their same idea of God, say that the same God encouraged both of them to do the same thing, and when it's a job really that only one person can do. And I think that that's such a challenging perspective. It is such a chore psychologically to whittle through that and say, yes, I believe this, and I recognize that that person believes it as well, but I don't know if they feel like maybe, well, he's just misguided. You know, he doesn't know, or he's just misinterpreting, or what? It's
so. Would you think the dissonance starts with, here are three candidates. They all express that this was ordained by God, that they would assume to this position. Do you think they find dissonance in each other?
I think that there has to be some there.
I mean, can God really want all three of us to do this?
Right.
I mean, are they thinking about that?
And I think that that's part of...
I mean, if God wants me, how can he want Rick Perry?
Right.
If God wants me, how can he want Rick Sam, you know?
Right. And I think that that's part of the really interesting question that I have about this. And you know, when it comes to this specific part of what we're going to talk about today, I don't have an answer. I don't know. Because I haven't had a chance to talk to a politician and say, you know, how do you negotiate this psychologically? How do you?
Yeah, how do you run this through your own brain?
Right.
And reconcile what looks like a contradiction.
Right. Right. And you know, where does it? How do you reconcile? I guess that's the best word. How do you reconcile when you come to the conclusion that this is beyond you, either financially or because you don't have the votes, to the point where you say, I have to drop out of the race. Well, just 2 weeks ago, you know, you were running on a platform that, you know, this was God's will. Right. This was what God wanted you to do. Mm-hmm. And now here you are saying, well, I'm dropping out of the race, and I'm going to support somebody else, or, mm-hmm. you know. So I think that dissonance, that conflict, that cognitive conflict, I think is a fascinating phenomenon that really takes stage during the political season, because you have, you know, religion is one way that comes out, and there's lots of other ways that these issues come out in politics. During election seasons, where people, you know, whether it's talking about education or talking about family systems or talking about human rights and those kind of things, there's lots of these types of issues that come out that just seem to be incongruous to what is really happening in the world. It feels like such a... It's even hard to talk about. You know, it's just been weighing on my mind all week long, and you know, I've been so excited to talk about it here on the podcast, and I'm still finding it hard to articulate about this specific piece. And we're gonna kind of generalize cognitive dissonance in a minute, but I wonder, you know, how many of you listening struggle with this? You know, how many of you were Rick Santorum supporters, mm-hmm. and you know, you believed, you know, many of his believers or his followers believed that he was chosen, and that right. how do the supporters manage that from a psychological perspective? You know, that from, you know, he was put there by God to lead us, and you know, now he's dropped out, and so now that can't be right. That can't be correct, yeah, because he's not now he isn't, you know, there's no way he can be president now because he's dropped out of the race. Mm-hmm. I you know, it, that this is the second podcast that I've run out of adjectives, but that dissonance is just so, it seems so massive. You know, it's different than saying, I believe that, believing that there's a colony on the dark side of the moon, and holding that belief when, you know, at least at this point, you know, we haven't been on the dark side of the moon, I don't think. We haven't covered the whole dark side of the moon. There could still be colonies there. You don't know. But that's how those arguments could happen, right? That's how people... Mm-hmm. Richard, did you know that there is a group of people, I think they refer to themselves as a society, that still believes that the Earth is flat?
Yeah, they're called the Flat Earth Society.
Yeah. Okay, so...
Sounds reasonable.
You can only see half of the Earth at a time, so how do you know that it's not flat? You know, you can, right? So, but that's how, you know, certainly the Flat Earth Society is different than the Dark Side of the Moon Colony Society that I'm going to start. But what I'm talking about is that kind of dissonance, that kind of, you know, holding a belief that is just... You know, there's just nothing to support it, but believing it anyways.
Right.
And for many people, I think that there's a few reasons why this happens. One example I think is maybe related to the political discussion that we're having, and another is related to other things. I think what's related to the political situation is, you know, I think that there's an argument that some people say those things. They choose their words well. Because, again, if you look at some of these statements that they make, if you look at the exact words they use, I think that it's typically that they were called to run for president, not necessarily serve as president. Though I think that when we hear it in their discussions, it's interpreted as... God has called me to be president, when really maybe what they're saying is, or what they're specifically saying is, he's called me to run for president, perhaps so that I can raise these issues, and maybe that's how they reconcile it, is just by using these words in a way to create a discussion, to be able to create a platform.
Do
to
they
talk
say
about
run?
They don't use, they use different words. God has called me to be a candidate for president of the United States. And again, I think when most people hear those things, they sort of interpret it as...
Be president.
Right. So I think one part of it is that it creates a situation or a platform where they can raise some awareness about something. Whether they truly believe it or not, you know, that's sort of notwithstanding. Sometimes, you know, we make those kinds of statements that appear to be cognitively dissonant, but, you know, is really serves a purpose for them. And so I think that that is one way that they're used. I think another thing that is important to consider, and something that certainly came to my mind, is that... you know, there is the possibility that those kinds of statements are used to create a supportive group, to create a foundation of supporters. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, many people, many of us believe that those types of values that these politicians and these individuals represent is something that our country needs more of. And so the candidates, knowing that, you know, they create a platform for that,
right.
And they say, you know, this is how I believe, and this is what I want to do. So you know, those are sort of two possibilities, I suppose, for why candidates do it. Now, for other people, maybe people in general who like the Flat Earth Society and the Dark Side of the Moon Colony Society, they hold these beliefs. Again, I think many times for some specific reasons, and we're going to sort of remove from that group the idea of people with delusional disorders and things like that, because that's a psychopathology that we shouldn't talk about and shouldn't be relevant because, or we shouldn't, is not relevant to this conversation because that pathology is very different. But some of those people, again, what we want as social beings is we want a group to fit into. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's a clique when we're in high school, whether it's a team when we play sports or whatever it may be, we often want a group that helps to identify us. And so for many people, they will sort of gravitate to some of these things. And whether they've, at least initially, fully believe that perspective or not, you know, they may feel like they can relate to that group, and they can associate with that group of people, and then they use that as a way to create a personal identity, to create a well-known musical artist, I think it's Bob, who has announced that he joined the Flat Earth Society.
Bob is his whole name.
Yeah, it's B-O-B, so it's an acronym. Oh. but he joined the Flat Earth Society, and you know, it's hard to imagine whether it's something because he really believes that, or if it creates a platform of potential supporters, and it's an identity that he wants to create for himself as this guy who thinks outside the box, and you know, those kinds of things. It's
for other people who think outside the box, I'm your man.
That's right. So I guess what I'm saying is sometimes cognitive dissonance can almost be used intentionally to create an identity or to create a personal image of yourself,
right,
that you want other people to see. And I think that a lot of people do that. I think politicians do that a lot of times. That, you know, remember in the, was it the 2012 election, it seemed like the little flag lapel pins kept getting bigger and bigger. And I think Saturday Night Live even did a joke about that, where they had this huge giant flag on their thing. Because the wanting to put forth the identity that I'm more American because I have a bigger flag lapel pin. We certainly have that need to create an identity for ourselves. You know, when we look at kids in high school, especially in certainly in middle school as well, where kids, a lot of kids begin to dress similarly. You know, they wear the same kinds of clothes, the same color of clothes and things like that. They want that identity. They want that, they want to know that they belong to something. Sure. So many times, cognitive dissonance is used for that purpose. That's what gangs many times are all about. Right. You know, again, referring to this as cognitive dissonance, that, you know, you want to be part of this quote-unquote family that is a gang. So to be part of this family, we're going to beat you in.
Right.
Okay, so everybody's going to beat me up so that I can be part of a family that cares about each other. Mm-hmm. That's some cognitive dissonance. That requires some real negotiation of how you're thinking about.
And we see that with any hazing rituals.
Right.
You know, whether fraternities, private schools, military academies. You know, there's a great Pat Conroy talks about the Lords of Discipline at the Citadel, you know, where they have these quite significant hazing rituals that
right.
last for your first year. And so that's some dissonance. You know,
right.
we're going to beat you up so that you stay.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, it's it's hard to put those things together. We recorded earlier today our education podcast.
Right.
And there's some cognitive dissonance there. You know, mm-hmm. we're going to continue to test despite the fact that there's no evidence that
despite
it's useful.
Despite the fact that it doesn't work, we're gonna keep doing it.
Right, right. And we deal with this with parents. You know, mm-hmm. parents who say in you know, gosh, if I could count the number of times that I've heard this, you know, he keeps doing it over and over again. And, you know, no matter how many times I spank him, he keeps right. doing it over and over again.
Right.
Well, perhaps the spanking isn't working. You know, the dissonance that, you know, if I keep doing, Einstein, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing repeatedly, right. but expecting different outcomes.
That's what he was talking about. this cognitive dissonance.
Right. It is certainly a type of cognitive dissonance.
In the face of all the evidence, I'm going to keep doing it.
Right. So with that sort of as a foundation, let's talk about then how we need to deal with it. I got to go on another podcast a couple of weeks ago. Very different podcast. I mentioned it, I think, in this podcast a couple of weeks ago. A very different podcast from what we do. And it's called Lost or Profound. And we were talking about some of these same types of issues, some of this cognitive dissonance. And the point brought up there was, people who are opposed to women serving in the military,
combat
roles in the military.
Right.
People who hold the perspective, well, that women can't do that.
Right.
The people who continue to hold the perspective that women can't serve as president because, they are too emotional or they can't rationalize things. I don't know what the argument is because it really doesn't hold much scientific evidence. There's really nothing to support those claims, but they hold those beliefs anyways. And what I talked about a little bit on that podcast and certainly want to spend some time here talking about is, so what do we do about it? How do we address these kinds of issues? Is it really likely, Richard, that if I firmly believe something, despite evidence of the contrary, what is the likelihood that you're going to convince me otherwise? Probably not very good.
Not very high.
Right. And one of the things that happens with it is when you address this issue with someone, if somebody went to Rick Santorum and say, sorry, man, I really don't believe that God called you to run for president, what is going to immediately happen is defenses are going to come up.
Right.
And what people do during those situations is they dig their feet in. So instead of being flexible and saying, well, let's talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
When you approach somebody and confront them about some of these issues or some of these cognitive distortions or the cognitive dissonance, they dig their feet in and they become more firmly rooted in their belief.
Right.
Which, of course, makes it more difficult for them to see the evidence perhaps that you're trying to present or understand rationally what evidence there is out there about it. So I think that there's several things that we can address with this. The first is we need to realize that for many of these people, many of these situations, we're not going to change their perspective. Those people who are firmly against Donald Trump, you're probably not going to win them over to become Trump supporters.
Mm-hmm.
They especially if you do it in a confrontational way. So one thing is that when it comes to some of these issues, again, especially politics, especially religion, you're not going to win them over. You're not very likely to win them over, especially through brute force. I'm not going to make you believe it.
Or through logic.
Oftentimes not through logic, right.
And I think there's a message here for parents. I mean, when our children make a decision, we have something called cognitive behavioral therapy.
Right.
We in our field, we have something called cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy. And the idea is that you change somebody's thinking in order to change their behavior. Prior to that, you just worked on the behavior. But then later on, we added this other step and said, well, if you change somebody's thinking, you can change their behavior.
Right.
And what we're saying is it's not always easy to change somebody's thinking.
Right.
Okay. So if you're a parent and you want to change your child's decision about something, let's say cell phone use at the dinner table.
Right.
What we're saying here is that you first of all need to know on what basis are they making this decision? Because if their decision is really close to them, such as religion is close to a person, it's going to be hard to change their minds.
Right. Because that goes back to what we were saying a minute ago. Many times these perspectives are part of our identity.
That's right.
And so what you're saying is that this part of who I am, you're saying that it's wrong. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I think that that's why the line for so many people between creationism and evolution is right. so strong, mm-hmm. because you're saying that, well, the scientific evidence disproves this, mm-hmm. or creationism disproves mm-hmm. evolution, and we create this black and white, yeah. and so I'm going to be on this side or I'm going to be on that side, right. and failing to recognize that there's lots of stuff in between, perhaps.
Right. But that argument is tied to one's belief system.
Right, in their identity.
Which makes it much more difficult to change their thinking, mm-hmm. because it's tied to their belief system.
Right.
The Flat Earth Society is probably not tied to somebody's belief system, so it may be easier to show the evidence to say, here's a satellite, it's circling, and it's going around in a circle.
Right. Okay.
Whereas if it's a belief system, there is no evidence. There is no logic. So when you start arguing with a teenager,
right.
you have to understand, how close is this issue to who she is or who he is? Because
right.
if it's their identity, they're going to dig in their heels.
Right.
Just as a politician would dig in his heels.
And how logically will mm-hmm. the teenager be able to rationalize it?
They're not going to do it logically. And right. a parent, you're not going to be able to convince them of your logic. It's too close to who they are.
Right.
The issue is too close to their person. And what we have to remember about teenagers is that it's all about identity. I mean, the driving force of the teenage years is the search for identity, who you are. It doesn't matter what the issue is, but once a teenager, let's take being gay.
Right.
You know, if a teenager is gay, no logic is going to talk that teenager out of that decision,
right.
because it's too close to their identity.
And it's always interesting because mm-hmm. what kids always... Not kids. What teenagers or even adults who come to terms with mm-hmm. homosexuality, what they always say is that it makes them so frustrated when people say it's just a phase.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because again, what you're saying is, because even if it is just a phase, by you saying that, it digs their heels in because they're saying, no, this is who I am.
That's right.
And what they're trying to say is, this is who I am. And who they are today may be different than who they will be in a year from now, mm-hmm. but that teenager, that young adult, many times doesn't
right.
realize that.
That's right.
They're not thinking that way. And so by trying to discount it mm-hmm. is often seen as a personal attack.
You're driving it deeper.
Right.
right.
Mm-hmm. So,
and that's why it's easier to change the mind of a you can take a three-year-old and distract a three-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple. You can distract the kid in elementary school. But once you get to those identity issues,
right.
such
right.
as we get with teenagers and adults, now you're bumping up against somebody's basic definition, basic of who I am and my basic identity.
Right.
And those are far more difficult to change. And you usually can't do it with logical arguments.
Right, right. And so so what I propose, what we propose.
There is a solution?
I think so. Well... For some, there's a solution, and the solution is for those who, you know, want to say or want to work and live life from the perspective that I'm going to try to not have these kinds of issues. I'm going to try to not live my life through these cognitive dissonance, through cognitive distortions. Mm-hmm. I want to remain open to the idea of different things. I think that the antidote to cognitive dissonance is critical thinking. Because when you are able to think critically, it helps remove some of that cloudiness that we get with cognitive dissonance. It helps remove some of that influence that's there that can keep you from having your mind open to other ideas and other thoughts. The issue, of course, is that we don't do a very good job anymore mm-hmm. of teaching critical thinking. We have lots of examples from our teaching experiences and life experiences that illustrate that.
Are you going to talk about Common Core?
No.
I am.
No.
No, because the irony of it is, I think you're right. I think critical thinking is what's necessary. And Common Core purports to do just that.
Right.
But our whole testing program is the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
Just fill in the bubble.
Right.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And fill in the bubble the right way.
With the right answer, and there's only one answer.
Right.
You know,
right.
That's not critical thinking.
Right. Okay. Right. So how do we create or foster good critical thinking skills? And I think that there are three components to
now, before to you do that. Now you're talking about, we started talking about these politicians who create, or at least should create, cognitive dissonance by what they're saying.
Right.
Now, are you talking about the people, or are you talking about parents who need to deal with the cognitive dissonance in their teenagers?
Right. I'm talking about cognitive dissonance for you as the individual. For you
so
to say,
I'm creating I have something where I'm creating cognitive dissonance.
Correct.
Okay.
If you decide, based upon what we're talking about today, and you say, you know what, I don't want to have that kind of problem. I don't want to be in a situation where I'm so rigid that I believe something despite all this evidence that says it's untrue. I don't want to fall into that trap. And so what these strategies I'm about to talk about do is help keep you from that.
So what you're saying is we don't want people to create, these are ways to avoid
right.
creating cognitive dissonance.
Right. Right.
And cognitive dissonance is I want to eat at a buffet, but I don't want to gain weight.
Right.
That's cognitive dissonance.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So what you're saying is, and that's a simple example.
Right.
Okay. What you're saying is there are ways to prevent creating cognitive dissonance.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Got it.
And the first thing is something that we talk about with parents very often, and that is you have to reduce your confrontation. One way if you believe something, let's work from, let's wait, maybe use an example to illustrate the 3 points. Let's say that you believe that women shouldn't serve combat positions in the military. So when somebody approaches you and says, hey, wait a minute, there's no reason why women shouldn't serve combat missions in the military, the first piece that you have to do is you have to avoid the temptation to become confrontational. Because what a lot of people do is again, they take it personal. And it's like, okay, well, he's attacking a firmly held belief that right. identifies me.
Right.
And so we have to avoid being confrontational in those situations and say, okay, let's talk about it. You know, tell me your perspective and I'll share with you my perspective. Mm-hmm. So the first step, and this is especially true for parents, when you're, you know, and I think your example a minute ago is spot on. You know, a lot of times parents want something from kids. And parents hold the perspective that this is completely necessary to be a fully functioning teenager.
Right.
And there may not be a lot of evidence to suggest that it is. Mm-hmm. We have to be non-confrontational in the way that we approach that. So the first step is non-confrontation. Because as soon as you enter into that conversation mm-hmm. with any mm-hmm. confrontational tone, the doors are going to shut, the feet are going to firmly plant, and you're not getting anywhere.
You're going to drive that stake into the ground.
Right. There is no hope for critical
thinking.
And
that's exactly what happens with teenagers.
Exactly.
They dig in their heels. All logic is, it doesn't matter what you say after that.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. The second step is to do something that a lot of teenagers do, though in somewhat of a restricted way, and that is research the topic.
Right.
You know, if
Google.
You... Right, Google it, but you know, be careful what website you're reading. But research the topic. You know, if you're going to believe something, be educated about it.
Right.
You know, what do other people say about it? And the really important piece of this research is look for people who are consistent with your belief, but also look for people who are inconsistent with your belief. Mm-hmm. Look at all the different angles and different sides of this. You know, what are really the arguments about women serving in combat missions? You know, what are really the beliefs that state for or against right. women serving in those positions? Because When you expose yourself to other people's ideas, other people's thoughts, you're informing yourself. And again, if you go into this non-confrontationally, and yes, I mean non-confrontationally, even with Google, don't go into it and say, oh, that guy's stupid. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right.
You know, that's not going to get you anywhere.
Right.
So approach it from a non-confrontational perspective so that you can then inform yourself of the information from different angles, from different perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
So non-confrontational, do your research. And the third piece is talking about it. You have to talk with other people about it. And even if you don't talk about it, write about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've often say that, you know, to really understand something, you have to, you know, if you really want to understand something, try to get it on paper. Try to put it in a way that other people understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that forces a level of understanding that goes a little bit deeper than just saying that you believe something and then being able to argue and say, no, I'm right, you're wrong, without facts, without being able to express yourself, because that requires a level of understanding that goes a little bit deeper.
Right. Yeah, when we talk about doing research, one of the places we always run into this is teenagers smoking weed.
Right.
And teenagers, all teenagers, every teenager I've ever worked with, and I've worked with dozens who are smoking, they all say the same thing. Weed should not even be a drug. I don't consider it a drug. It's a plant.
It's legal everywhere else.
It's legal in a lot of states. It should be legal here. And it's not harmful. And it's not addictive. Okay? That's because they go to Google. They all read the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there are advocates out there who want you to believe that. Well, as a matter of fact, it is addictive. It's not harmless, especially in the teenage brain, but they're not reading that research.
Okay? Right, because what they're doing is they're only reading the research that supports their perspective.
Right.
And oftentimes, that perspective is extrapolated from, mm-hmm. quote-unquote, research from a different population.
Right.
It's just like alcohol.
It's less harmful,
maybe perhaps a little bit less harmful
mm-hmm.
in adults than it is in teenagers.
The problem with parents, if you're listening to this and you have teenagers who are experimenting or using or abusing, would you allow your children to participate in a research project where they could smoke marijuana? No.
Right.
So teenagers are not available for research with marijuana.
Right.
Okay. So the research that we're reading is about adults.
Right.
And cannabis has one effect in an adult brain,
right.
but a very different effect in a teenage brain.
Because the teenage brain is still developing.
Right. But the teenagers aren't reading the research because there isn't enough research in our country. Now, there are other countries who are experimenting on teenagers, but the United States isn't one of them. And so we don't have the research that they need
right.
to make that decision. They're reading research based on adult subjects.
Right.
So this is a very good example. And you're not going to change their mind.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing I can say to them. I mean, I can tell them, but they're not going to believe it.
Right.
And I'm not going to change them by the logic of my argument or the research that I present to them.
Right. And so what you as the parent needs to do is, if you feel like your son or daughter, teenage son or daughter, is smoking marijuana, instead of being confrontational with them, which is going to do nothing except for make them more vigilant
they're going to dig their heels in.
Right.
You're stupid. You don't know what you're talking about. I'm right. And they're going to dig their heels in and you're going to drive them farther away.
Right. So be non-confrontational. Mm-hmm. Do your research. Read the same stuff that they're reading so that mm-hmm. when they bring up that argument, you can say, hey, wait a minute. I read that that as well. And did you recognize this piece? Or did you mm-hmm. notice that they're really talking about 30-year-old adult males
right.
who are smoking it, not 15-year-old right. females?
Right.
You know, and so inform yourself of mm-hmm. it and then be able to come back and say, but how about this article that
right.
from, you know, this university that says this?
That's right.
But be able to have this conversation, again, in a non-confrontational way. And then that third piece is that you're talking to them then about
That's
it.
That's right.
You know?
And fortunately, the National Institutes of Mental Health has started to do some research with, and they're getting teenagers who have been smoking, and they're doing some brain studies on them. And in fact, that research is available. You know, if you want it, give us a call. I can give you those references if parents want literature that they can use that is based on teenagers.
Right.
You know,
right.
The evidence is, the data coming in so far is, marijuana is not benign in teenagers.
Right. And you know, not that we're doing this whole podcast about drug substance use in teenagers, but, you know, let us not forget that every movement about marijuana use, the only time it has ever been used or allowed for children or adolescents is in the case of illness,
right,
as a medication treatment. Right. It's never been discussed as a recreational use, mm-mm, for children and adolescents.
No. Or even as a psychotropic.
Right.
You know.
So we, you know, that point is critical. But when you're talking about, again, when you're talking about trying to resolve this conflict,
mm-hmm,
the conflict and the cognitive dissonance there is that the kids firmly believe that it's harmless, despite evidence, beliefs that not only is that probably not true,
right,
but it's still illegal, at least here in Florida. It's still
lest
illegal.
Lest we forget.
So we have to negotiate that. And again, it's best to negotiate that through non-confrontational approach, doing, mm-hmm, your research, and then talking about it.
Right.
And I would talk about it to lots of other people, not just the person with whom you're having the conflict, mm-hmm, but talk about it with other people as well. You would be surprised to hear what other people say about some of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to sort of wrap back around to the initial topic of that dissonance with our political candidates. I was talking with somebody the other day who is somewhat of a theologian. I mean, he does a lot of religious studies and things like that. And you know, I thought it would be interesting to have the conversation with him just to kind of see what he says. And I was surprised to hear from him. He goes, you know, I think that a lot of them just say it because they think that that's going to get them votes. Now, I would have never, you know, certainly that's something that's in the back of your mind, but I never would have imagined him saying that because, you know, because he's a very deeply religious person. And so you never know when you start talking about it, you start getting so many of these other perspectives. You start getting, you start thinking about things and talking about things that perhaps you never would have imagined talking about, and from perspectives that you would have never imagined that were available.
Right.
But what happens, again, you know, the two things that you're never allowed to talk about are religion and politics. We sort of refrain from having these discussions with other people. And all that does, because for the reasons that we talked about earlier, all that does is allows us to reinforce our own beliefs, because we only look for evidence that supports how we feel about it, what we think about it. And when we only look for that evidence, we cut off so much other information. We don't expose ourselves to information that would be would and could be very critical to our decision making. And so that's why I say that critical thinking is the antidote to prevent cognitive dissonance, because if you are a critical thinker, you are really going to reduce and cut down the likelihood of having these kinds of beliefs that just don't hold up to the evidence.
Right. It's something we tell. I taught a class yesterday to graduate students, and I said to them during the class, I said, you have to be quietly suspicious of the information that you get. You know, and I think that's the best. You don't have to get on a soapbox. You don't have to become a firebrand. You don't have to become a revolutionary. But when you get these articles and you hear things about Common Core or testing or a school choice, you begin by being quietly suspicious.
Right.
That's a synonym for critical thinking.
Yeah.
You know, think about it critically. Don't get angry. Don't get upset. It's not an emotional issue, but think about it critically.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. As a quick example, because we can talk to patients sometimes like this. I was seeing a teenager the other day, and he was he's a little depressed, and he was talking about how his parents are divorced because he did this and he did that, and if I hadn't been born, then my mom wouldn't have married my dad because the only reason she married him is because she wanted a kid, and as he's talking about this, I go, well, you know, and if you would have passed that math test last week, ISIS wouldn't have, taken control of the Middle East. And he looks at me like, what? I said, you're putting all these pieces together that are just not even related and have nothing to do with any decisions that you made.
Right.
And so we worked through that session to try to sort of dispel some of these. Distortions that
distorted
are
distorted thinking
that's influencing his mood and how he feels it. And so, you know, we left the session and he was actually seemed to be feeling much better because we have to realize that, you know, we do have these beliefs and everyone listening, you know, if you are the typical person, you have some of these,
right.
You have some beliefs that you hold firm that maybe need to be questioned a little bit, maybe need to be looked into a little bit. They may not be things that heavily influence decisions that you make every day. Absolutely not. You know, these may be just simple thoughts and perspectives that the world is flat that you have in the back of your head. And it doesn't affect your ability to do your job on a day-to-day basis, unless you draw maps, because I guess if the world was flat and you draw maps, that would probably be problematic. But these, you know, we have some of these cognitive dissonance that we hold, and if we step back and we say, you know, let me look into this a little bit. You know, this is a belief that I have that really influences a lot of decisions that I make. It influences the way that I see the world. It influences the way that I interact and value and maybe even judge other people. Let me step back and look at this and really evaluate this a little bit in this critical thinking type of way where you're going to be non-confrontational, do your research, and then talk with others about it. I think what we will find is that we become a lot more open-minded to things, a lot more accepting of other people's perspectives. And that certainly would make life a little bit easier for many of us, right? Don't you think?
I think critically.
Let me do some research on that. All right. So, you know, we entitled it Religion, Politics, and Cognitive Dissonance. But thankfully, I suppose, we were only on the religion and politics stuff.
I was a little nervous when you said we're going to talk about religion and politics. I said, those are two things we don't talk about.
Right.
Even at Thanksgiving. Even with family. But no, the cognitive dissonance issue is important individually,
right?
And it's important for parents, especially parents of teenagers,
right?
Because they encounter this on a regular basis.
Absolutely, and you know, again, we have to, as we always say, you know, we need to be cognizant of these things if we want to do anything about them. We have to anticipate that. We have to call it for what it is. We have to realize what it is, and then actively do something about
it.
That's right. And of course, actively doing something about it does not mean strong arm people to believe like we believe.
Right. You can't force them, and you can't logic them.
Right.
I mean, it's not going to work.
It's just not going to work.
They're not going to accept it.
And so you have to get to the point where you say, you know, this is how it impacts me, and this is what I'm going to do about that.
That's right.
Otherwise, you believe what you believe, and we will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right.
Okay.
Well, I think that's it for today. We made it.
Less
than an hour. So we will be back next week. We'll see what we talk about next week. We'll figure something out, I'm sure.
There'll be lots of educational stuff to talk about.
Oh, yeah. The Paideia podcast is... we've been talking a lot about that. All right. So until next week, I'm Dr. Bernie.
I'm Dr. Richard.
Have a terrific week and forget to be afraid.